mundo. Hello and welcome to the Gestalten Podcast. My name is Martin Groschwald, and we are continuing our series on car design in Asia, and we will today start to focus on Japan. Japan has, of course, been the biggest impact of car design into the world from Asia for a very, very, very long time. And it is my absolute pleasure to give you what I would probably call a world-exclusive conversation with Toyota's head of design and also board member of the Toyota Corporation, Simon Humphries. Now, a lot of you know, of course, Toyota, but not necessarily that Simon is the head of design. And even most importantly, he is the chief branding officer for Toyota. What that actually means, how design is seen at Toyota and also in Japan, his experience being in Japan for like 30 plus years, his beginnings coming from England into the country, and many, many other things we will be discussing in the next little bit over an hour in this absolutely fascinating conversation. And you will not hear from Simon in many other places. So please do absolutely enjoy. Let us know how you like the conversations, maybe questions that you have for him later on that we might revisit again in the future. But now, without further ado, this is Car Design in Asia with a focus on Japan, with Simon Humphries, the Chief Branding Officer and Global Head of Design for the Toyota Corporation. Let's go. Simon, welcome to the Gestalten Podcast. And it's an absolute pleasure to have you here. I'm in Munich, you're in Japan. So welcome to the party over here. And how is everything in Japan?
Yeah, well, thanks for inviting me. You know, everything in Japan is busy as usual, in lots of meanings of the word. But yeah, we're just going through winter, getting into the ski season, enjoying ourselves. Other than that, yeah, everything is just usual.
Ski season is just ending here in Germany. You know, when it goes into March, it's slowly going down. But what we want to talk about is car design in Japan, and also a lot about the culture that surrounds it as well. And we'll get to that obviously in a little bit. But usually when we do these podcast series, and especially in the Asia one, you know, we have one guest who is the local one. So in that sense, in your case, the Japanese one, and one who's the foreigner. Now, in your perspective, you're now the local one, because you've been in Japan for such a long time. I remember we had conversations where you and the family feel very much Japanese. You speak fluent Japanese and everything as well. But before we dive into that, can you share a little bit, coming from England, what brought you over to Japan? Because that's, even up till today, there's not that many foreign designers in Japan. I mean, there's a few, but, you know, it's not like a massive amount as we have, you know, foreigners in Europe or even in the US. And now going back 30 years, you must have been an anomaly in terms of, you know, over as a guy from the UK. How did that happen? And what was your motivation, the kind of, you know, why did you move over? What's the background for this?
Well, yeah. You know, looking back on it now, you know, the first thing I have to say, it's kind of as a disclaimer, you know, it was never really my intention to be here for 35 years and continuing. It's one of those things. I mean, you know, a lot of people, I mean, if you look back over your life, there's a lot of things that just seem to have worked out that way. And perhaps for me, this was one of them. You know, when I was at college, I was at Leicester Polytechnic in those days, in the mid 80s, and they used to have, it was called a design bursary. And it was run by the Royal Society of Arts. And this was it's kind of a big thing, you know, amongst students at that time. You know, it was one of those competitions that, you know, if you won it, then it was a really good thing to have on your CV. Let's put it that way. It opened doors. And I was very, very lucky to win one of those bursaries, which was for a product that was basically an answer phone, I suppose, you know, and it was sponsored by Sony. After I won that, they invited me over to come all the way to Tokyo. This is in 1988. They invited me over there and they said, you can come here. And it was a sort of work experience type of thing, you know? And I think, Martin, you know that at that time in Japan, I mean, that was literally the height of the bubble, the so-called bubble economy. And yeah. I came from the north of England, and I came out here, and there was, you know, wall-to-wall Walkmans and houses with warm toilet seats in them that took your temperature and did all sorts of this wacky, zany innovation. And I went to Sony, of course, and Sony was at the peak of its powers at that time. At least that's what I thought. And I thought it was absolutely amazing. It was wild. I finished that and I went back to work in England, actually. I worked for an incredible company there called David Carter Associates, which was a DCA, it was called. I was a product mm-hmm. designer, actually, at the time. I got a great job there, and I was designing trains and this, that, and the other, and products, golf clubs, all sorts of stuff. And then just one day, somebody in the office, they said to me, you know, Simon, you've been out to Japan, haven't you? And I said, yeah, I was there a couple of years ago. And they said, there's somebody advertising for a job. And I thought, well, why not? I'll give it a go. And it was, don't tell anybody. It really wasn't that serious at the time. I give it a go and see what it was all about. And I got the job. And I was back out there at the end of, at the end of 89. That was for a small product design company in Nagoya. And again, I nothing to do with cars. Absolutely nothing. I was designing bathrooms and video cameras and all that sort of stuff. And that was that. And that went on until 1994. And then again, by chance, someone said, oh, Toyota's advertising for designers. And, you know, and it sounds crazy, yeah, but I'd never drawn a car in my life by that point.
Yeah.
I went for the interview. I drew a bunch of cars and lo and behold, got a job here. I've been here ever since. So I came in as a regular Japanese employee. In other words, I wasn't hired from overseas and brought in. I was here. And I've been here ever since. And, you know, I still to this day think that one of the best things that this company can ever say is that it's an open environment where they were willing to give me a chance. You know, I think that would have been different in some other companies around the world, to be honest with you. And that really meant a lot to me. I've never forgotten that, really.
Yeah. How can we imagine this? Because I remember in a past conversation when you told me about that starting point, you said there weren't a lot of foreigners, but you were one of very few. So was there, when you found out later, a wish for a British person or a European to come in? Or did they just say like, no, you were great, you fit in what we're doing over here, and you just happened to be here, and that's why we want to bring you in? What was that like at that time when they brought you on board? Because it feels so surreal at that point, I think, yeah, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, and, you know, even now, you know, looking back, I was the only foreigner here. And to all intents and purposes, I'm one of very few now as well. So I think at the time, it was still just, you know, the bubble had finished and there was a little bit of uncertainty. Was it going to start back up again, the economy? There was still that sort of desire, I think, from the Japanese side to explore globally, to know more, to understand more. And they're very curious, I think, as a nation. And maybe nobody's ever really told me, you know, but I think, you know, in some ways it was a little bit of a win-win situation. They could get a soft landing. I spoke a little bit of Japanese by that time. I kind of understood the culture. It wasn't going to be a case of employing me and then me deciding to go home 2 weeks later because I wanted to drink, you know, Guinness and eat cheese sandwiches or something like that, you know? They were willing to give me a chance. And I, one other thing, and that was that the company I used to work at, we started using computers for design quite early on, actually. You know, at the end of 89, we had an Apple, you know, computer, and we tiny little screen, and we used to do the engine drawings on that. And funnily enough, we were a little bit ahead of the curve on that. And I think that was one part of it as well. There was nobody here really using computers in design anyway. And so there was that. But I think the main thing was just, you know, even at that time, there was an understanding that diversity in design is important.
Yeah.
And just, you know, bringing in a different opinion. And, you know, I got to say it, looking back now, it's weird because I was young still at the time, in my 20s. And, you know, I remember going to design reviews and they turn around to me and say, you know, the old bosses at the time, they say, so Simon, what do you think about that? You know, I was getting a chance to voice my opinion at a very early stage, which puts a lot of pressure on you. But
Yeah.
At the same time, I think that they genuinely valued, you know, outside, in inverted commas, you know, opinion, you know, a different upbringing, different culture. So yeah, I think that was the win-win scenario. Anyway,
yeah.
I hope it was win-win anyway.
Well, considering, you know, that Toyota's single brand, by far the biggest manufacturer in the world now, I think, you know, there's some win-win definitely in there. So you can, you know, pat yourself on the shoulder there a little bit. But I want to jump quickly on the culture, because there is, I don't want to call it a misconception, but when we look into Asian culture from a Western perspective, it always looks very hierarchical. And especially what we see also in China at the moment, you know, the boss says something and you bow down and that's what you do. Now, what you're saying is a completely different perspective on this. Is this a Toyota thing, or is this something that is actually hidden within Japanese culture, but it's just not seen from an outsider's perspective, or not seen in the first layer when you touch the surface?
Yeah, you touched on a good one there, Martin. You know, I think the first thing to remember is don't lump the Asian countries together. Japan, China, yeah. Korea, and all the Southeast Asia as well. They're all very, very different in the way that they function. So I think, you know, a lot of that is a Japanese thing. And I absolutely agree with you. A lot of people looking from the outside, and I've had the same question year after, you know, from over the years, it looks very hierarchical or authoritarian in a way. One person at the top speaks and then everybody, you know, falls in line. And I got to tell you, it's completely the opposite. Okay. Yeah. I think Japanese work style and Japanese culture, for that matter, is very flat in a good way. They also have a lot of idiosyncrasies in the way that the language works. In other words, the language is very vague when you speak to people. And again, this is something that's incredibly difficult to understand and to explain. But yes can mean no, and no can mean yes. And I think that this is something that can drive certain foreigners completely up the wall, so much as that they just can't take it anymore and they'll bail out of the country. And for others, and maybe that includes me, you know, I saw it as more as a positive thing, as if I was being offered the chance to kind of do what I wanted to do. So I think, you know, that a lot of the time, the opportunity and the flexibility is there in Japanese society, in Japanese companies. The question is whether or not people are willing to step up and take it, you know, and that is a different problem. So I think, you know, and I've explained this to people over the years, and I think that they can understand that, but I certainly feel within Toyota, one of its strongest points, and together with the Japanese culture, is that there is that opportunity for you to say, how about doing something like this? And then you can get a fair look in at that point. And it doesn't have to be, and this is maybe Toyotaism coming into it, it doesn't have to have reams of reports and evidence and everything with it. You know, it's literally, you know, this looks cool. How about something like this? What do you think?
Yeah.
And I got to say, you may have met him over the years, I don't know, but, you know, Akio Toyoda is you know, the chairman of our company. He's very much aligned with that sort of way of thinking. And I think that's one of, and this is not lip service in any way, this is a truth. You know, I think that his support, if you like, of design, and design needs support in any company. I think, Martin, you know that well. Anybody, any designer who tells you, yeah, I can do that, I can do it all alone, is sadly mistaken, I think, in my mind. You know, designers need basically managerial support, they need engineering support, they need financial support, and not just support, but understanding to function at their best, you know, without a doubt. And it's, you know, and that part of it, in a lot of companies, sadly, is not there. And I think that's, you know, critically underestimated perhaps by a lot of designers about how much, you know, support from the company as a whole they need to be able to function at their highest level.
Yeah. Jumping into that quickly, obviously your official job title is Chief Brand Officer. So it's not Chief Design Officer or Chief Creative Officer, which obviously moves this kind of idea of importance within the company even further up. Yeah. Because for, I think, let's say the normal board members, they would say brand is higher than design. It's like a bigger statement out into the world. And it's a kind of recognition that comes to that as well. Do you think that because of this move, yeah, where you have the brand and also the design is part of your function in that context. The collaboration with the other departments, therefore, is a little bit easier so that it helps to balance things out a little bit as well, to get that respect, to get that collaboration that you were just talking about. Because I 100% agree in what you just said. And if I look in particular into Europe, yeah, or even into the American companies, we might have a chief design officer, but then you have still marketing, still brand, still to some degree, even experiences, where then these roles are split and you have four people deciding on actually one major topic in terms of brand, you know, values and recognition. So do you think that move in itself, because it's unusual, and then it's more unusual that a designer or a natively designer runs it, has helped that kind of recognition as well and the success that you guys had over the past 10, 15 years now?
Yeah, I think that, you know, for us anyway, we have a sort of a saying within Toyota, yeah, that the Toyota is managed by product. And it doesn't work so well in English. It's a little bit better. But essentially, you know, I think there are various ways to manage a company. You know, if you can manage it by numbers, you can manage it by profit, you can manage by efficiency, you can do all these sort of things. But one thing that's very, very clear in this company, at least anyway, and that is, again, going back to Akio Toyota, is that what he says is that finally, you'll point a finger and say, this is a company that basically, you know, shows what it's about, what it believes in, where it's going by its product. End of story. Now, I think when you come to the branding issue, like for me, I'm chief branding officer, but I think that is a part of that issue. I think there are probably other companies that maybe see branding as advertising or marketing or something like that, but it's not that part in our case. So it's a kind of a natural evolution, if you like, for me from where I was before as head of design, and still am, but to say, okay, when I bring a product along for Lexus or for Toyota or for whatever else, GR, then it's also got a story that is, you know, part of the brand evolution of those, mm-hmm. you know, particular brands. So essentially we are managing by product, and a large part of the product is design. And to enable good design, we have to, you know, put a flag in the sand that says we need this type of engineering approach or this type of sales approach or whatever else it might be. So all those things are actually not clear cut entities. They're all very much interlocked, you know, interlinked with each other. So yeah, that's the way it works, Martin. I think just simply that the branding part is an extension of, you know, product development.
Yeah. You know what this reminds me? It's interesting. I think it was like last week or like 2 weeks ago, I watched a documentary on Nintendo, and Nintendo is very similar in that context as well. It's this product, and it's also about, it's never about the fanciest graphics, it's never about the fanciest components, but it's about this overall experience and product that's supposed to give as many people as possible a positive experience and a positive image, you know. And it's really funny because when you look at that, in my opinion, is the Japanese companies have been doing exactly something like that extremely well, yeah, and have been able to adapt and develop through that as well. And the closest for me personally that I've come to that kind of approach were the Koreans over the past years, to kind of say, hey, we take some good ideas from that as well. But why do you think something like this, that mindset, has maybe not caught on properly in, let's say, in Europe or in America? Is it just because it's Japan, it's very far away from those guys? Or is it also coming back to this attitude that you have mentioned, you know, people see that first layer, but they don't understand what happens on the bottom of it, so that this bottom work, it goes top to bottom and bottom to top to kind of sort each other out and itself out to get the best possible product and allow for that, you know, for these kind of ideas to swim through all these different kind of layers, because that's that kind of combination then seems very unique in the world.
Yeah, it is. And when it comes to product development, you know, the two well-known ways to do it, market in, product out, you know, I think that's what a lot of people talk about. Yeah. I don't think that Japan is either, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. And we are certainly not. And, you know, I think there's a lot of interesting examples. You know, when I first came here, I could never believe you go to buy a can of beer in the shop. Yeah. And in Europe, you buy 350 milliliters or maybe a 500 milliliter can. That's it. You know what they've got here? They've got 135 milliliter, tiny one. They've got 250, 350. They've got 500, 750, 1 liter, 2 liter, 3 liter cans. Okay. All of the same beer.
Yeah.
Now, yeah. Okay. You know, that is maybe overkill, but I think it gives you a kind of an insight into the way that they think. You know, it's about trying to anticipate every situation that a possible customer might be in. So
yeah.
Okay, I just want a quick drink, you know, at lunchtime. And so I buy a tiny little one and that's it. It's done with. I'm drinking with friends. So by then they want to pour it for everybody. So let's buy a 2 liter can. And it's kind of imagining those eventualities, you know, from a customer point of view. God, I wish I didn't have that size. I wish I had this one. And coming back to my job or my business, you know, over the years, Martin, I've been asked, you know, as head of design anyway, you know, particularly by the Europeans, why don't you make everything look a lot more similar? Yeah. You know, why don't you, you know, put the same face on every single car? And I my reply is very, very simple, is that I don't think that's what our customers want. You know, I think that for a brand like Toyota, where you're designing something, for example, like the Land Cruiser, you know, the next day you're designing something like the Prius or in Europe, the Aygo or something like that. And I'll guarantee you one thing, that somebody goes to buy a Land Cruiser, he doesn't want the same, you know, basic design concept as a Prius or an Aygo. You know, he wants to know that he has the ultimate, the, you know, 150% pure product that he's looking for. You know, put it another way, every single one of our, you know, concepts is kind of like an honest representation of what they are. And I think this is something that is, in a way, inherently Japanese. If you look at any of the big electronics makers over the years, Sony and Panasonic's of the world and everything, they do much the same thing. And I think that's an interesting way to look at stuff. And I think that's what's underpinned maybe a lot of what's been successful about our last 5-6 years, is that ability to look at customers and say, yeah, you know, it's not doing an FGI and just saying, oh, they asked me for this, so I'll give them it. It's about listening and then going one step, two step further. But it's about understanding, you know.
So do you think that, look into Germany, and when people look about German car design, the first thing that comes to mind is always this Bauhaus idea, you know, and just, okay, you know, we make a connection there. But from what you're saying, my question would be, is there anything that you would say specifically a Japanese car design, or is this more something like, you know, it's this environment that affects on how you do certain kind of things as well? Or is there maybe nothing like a Japanese design or car design in that context, that you know, pinpoint into every Japanese car that comes from the country and says, like, that's why it is from Japan? Because to a degree, we have that in France, to a degree, we have this in Italy, and sometimes even in America, I would say pickup trucks and stuff. But is there anything like it? Anything that you would say, well, I do feel there is something particularly Japanese about Japanese products? Or is it a feeling, is it a cultural implication that comes with it as well?
What I believe is that the Japanese design, if you like, should be, I think the main positive aspect historically and now is the attention to the concept. In other words, what you're giving somebody in terms of value when they buy that car. And within that concept is the willingness to redefine what they've been doing up until now. I think that's also is an inherent, you know, for better or for worse, and I'm a European, so I can speak like that. I think a lot of the value of European design, and this is not just about the automotive industry, it's also about heritage, it's about authenticity, it's about consistency in that respect. And I think what Japan has done, sometimes it doesn't, okay? You know, but I think, you know, if we look at the average over the last 30, 40 years, they've innovated, you know, and their willingness to say, okay, how about a car that's tall? How about a car that emphasizes space? How about a car that's in the A segment, but it's an SUV? How about a car that's blah, blah, blah? You know, those are the things that we've been doing. But I would love to, you know, for finally for people to say, wow, yeah. What I think about Japanese design is it's not styling. It's about, you know, inventing, I think, you know, a little bit more perhaps than other places. So, yeah, it's very difficult because I think that none of these ways are, there's not a wrong or a right in this, Martin, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I honestly believe, and I love the fact that there's so much variety out there. You know, I think that's an incredibly important part of life, you know? It would be so boring if everybody got the same. And, you know, so what the Europeans do, what the Americans do, it's all great. And what the Koreans do, what the Chinese are doing at the moment as well,
yeah.
It's fantastic. You know, I just look there and wow, there's a big enough pie out there for everybody. So, but I think going back to Japanese, it's innovation that should be at the heart of what everything that Japan does and the ability to change, not to say, well, you know, that's as far as it goes and we're going to continue doing that forever. You know, just stop on a little bit of a tangent, you know. Again, you know, I came to Japan, you know, 30 years ago, and I don't know whether you know, the Japanese toilets, you know, traditionally,
mm-hmm. Of course,
they're basically squat, you know, you squat to go to the toilet. And they started bringing Western toilets in. And before you know it, they've got the warm toilet seats on it. So you go skiing in the winter and you sit down on the toilet seat and it's hot, you know. Okay, yeah, that's perfect. Next thing you know, it's got what is essentially a bidet built into it. You know?
Yeah.
The next thing you know, it's got other health functions that are built into it. The next thing you know, it's got a dryer and whatever else. You know? And it's this, I don't know, it's this desire to not stand still on the spot with stuff, you know, and just say, okay, yeah, we had a sedan. Great. We've had those for 60, 70, 80, whatever, how many years. You know, how about lifting it up, making it somewhere in between an SUV? How about doing this? How about doing that? And I think that that's the type of thing that they should be confident in doing. You know, I think that's a plus point, you know, that they have in this society.
This sounds very intrinsic. Yeah. To say like, oh, we have something and how can we, you know, develop this further? And, you know, I'm a big video games guy, so we'll talk about video games a little bit later. But like, you have this as well, you know, this kind of idea of constantly developing it further. But I want to talk about the external impact. What I'm really keen on finding out, and I don't know if you have an answer to this, but if you look at Japanese culture over the past, I would say 5-10 years, it has made a massive impact in Western culture. So, you know, when I look here in Munich, the amount of ramen restaurants, sushi places, like all these things, they have exploded. Yeah, I think 10 years ago, you might have had 2 or 3. Now you're having 30, 40 in the city over here. If you look into the manga culture, the anime culture, but also if you look into the fine arts, yeah, look into the importance nowadays of a hokusai. You know, it's Hiroshige's anniversary this year. There's special exhibitions, I even think in London on that as well. Has this changed, you know, people in Japan kind of see their own culture or like how they design certain kind of products and also for US cars? Because there's a higher appreciation of the culture as well. It's like, look, there's this admiration for Japanese culture on many different levels, where beforehand was like, okay, we buy the Toyota because it's very reliable and, you know, the warranties and all these kind of things. And now it's becoming a cultural phenomenon that goes along in that as well. Has this changed how you work with the team, how you look into products as well, to maybe say like, hey, we can be proud to become a bit more Japanese in the way we're doing things?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, Martin. You know, and I think just, again, stepping one step back and you know, understanding why that's happened. I think that, you know, if you look at the world in general, you know, when I was young anyway, in the, you know, I was born the '60s, but in the '70s, when I grew up, you know, everybody wore flared trousers for I don't know how many years. And then after that, you got to the '80s and you all wore sort of straight trousers, skin tight sort of jeans and stuff like that. And at that time, there was huge mega trends that were kind of defining everything that was going on. And I think one of the things that's led to a situation that you've just described is simply that people all around the world now, for one reason or another, are incredibly confident in the way that they can choose things. You know, they can, you know, and this ability to, well, I don't care what Martin's wearing. I'm going to go for this. And, you know, you could be in the same group of friends and have very different music tastes or fashion tastes or tastes in food or whatever else it might be. And the opening of that door has allowed this to come forward. People are inquisitive naturally. You know, as a human beings, we are so incredibly illogical. You know, every other animal on this planet, you know, lives where it's comfortable. We want to go to space. There's no air there. You know, why is that possible? I don't know. You know, and I think it's that, you know, basically inquisitive nature, and that has grown and grown and grown. And it's not just Japan. It's other regions, you know, what's happening in India, Southeast Asia, in Africa, in all these places are all got so much culture and interest, and people are soaking that up right now. I think that's a fabulous place to be. Has it influenced the way we work? Yes, absolutely. And I can tell you, you know, one thing that I've been harking on for a long, long time, and that's, for example, a brand like Lexus. The Italians are proud of their vehicles. The Germans are proud of their vehicles. The English, when we had a full auto industry, you know, they're proud of the vehicles as well. You know, everybody has that cultural, how can I say, background that they want to put into the car. And one of the things I'm trying to do here is to say to Japanese who are inherently modest about these things, be aware, be proud, you know, make it part of the Lexus brand, you know, the taste, you know, for example, you know, we're even, you know, putting bamboo, you know, recycling, something that's literally growing everywhere in this country, you know, and it's a pest, basically. And linking up with, you know, communities that don't have the ability to control that stuff and monifying this, you know, it's great. It's a win-win. So, you know, it's things like that, but it may be more literal meanings of doing something as well. Even down to, you know, it's not well known in Europe, but we have a car here called the Century, which is like literally mm-hmm. the top.
Yeah.
And I think that car was originally conceived in the 1960s as a sort of a standard bearer, if you like, for Japanese, what we call in Japanese is monotsukuri. You know, in other words, it's the mm-hmm. it's making things, you know, that ability to make stuff. So yes, you're absolutely right. In the Scion brand in the States that we had, you know, a few years ago, that was also heavily based on manga culture, actually,
yeah.
You know, in reality. So yeah, I think that what's changed now is that there is definitely, you don't have to push anybody anymore to do that. And you know what, Martin, one of the interesting things is that a lot of that push that is there comes from designers overseas.
Yeah.
You know, and that's interesting in its own way, because it's really, in some ways, it's a lot easier to interpret culture from an outside point of view.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in Japan and you're immersed in that and you know all the background, in some ways it's, yeah, okay, how am I going to redefine the kimono, you know? That's a daunting task, you know, for something that's been around for literally thousands of years, you know. So, you know, I get it. I think that, you know, our designers, at least overseas designers, they should be really confident in proposing that, you know, and saying, look, in Japan, if you go into McDonald's here, they have a teriyaki burger. So it's basically, it's a regular sort of, you know, hamburger, you know, beef burger, whatever, hamburger, yeah. But it's dipped in teriyaki sauce. Sometime of the year, you can get it with a fried egg on top in McDonald's. Yeah. They've done that in reverse, you know, what I'm talking about, but in reverse.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they've literally soaked in a part of another culture and put it together with their own. And I think there's a willingness to do that. So bring it on. I think there's, I think it opens up a whole new avenue. So, you know, it's really interesting.
This is a little bit of my wish, and I hope this will come through. But like, you know, I would love to see K cars making a move in particular over to Europe. You know, we're talking, you know, in terms of mobility at the moment about smaller vehicles, smaller electric vehicles when it comes to those kind of things. And, you know, you look into Japan, and I tell like so many people all the time, it's like, just look into Tokyo, like go to Tokyo and you see so many K cars, you see how practical they are. They still fit four people in, and like, you know, yeah, okay, it's not like a car that runs on 150, 180 kilometers an hour on the motorway. But if you've ever been to Tokyo, you don't need that because it's the bloody biggest city in the world. So you know, it just works a little bit differently. But that's what I think, you know, a lot of this kind of cultural adaptation is coming into that as well. And I hope that more and more products will make that kind of move over, because it's also just fundamentally a global cultural development. If we have less space in a city, well, our vehicles need to be smaller as well. It's just a very logical thing to happen. And, you know, it's not like we're reinventing the world. Tokyo had to do it 25 years ago because it just ran out of space.
Yeah. You know, the K car industry, I guess that everybody maybe who's listening, you know, understands it. That's actually, you know, defined by law, the size, the maximum size of the vehicle, the engine capacity. You know, there's a very strict regulation around that. But what's really interesting is you put those limitations on something. And because of that, innovation starts to occur, you know, happens. Yeah. You know, I think that you look at those cars, they're incredible. The amount of space you can get inside the vehicle, considering its footprint, you know, the innovations they've done to be able to do that. And the designers have worked incredibly with so little material to work with, if you like, there's no excess there. It's pared down to the absolute minimum. And then you see stuff like the K trucks, you know, the little, basically pickup trucks, you know, with a cab over, the engine's literally underneath the seat. Yeah, I mean, you know, I see those on YouTube, and there's people in America buying those things, which is
in Germany as well. Just incredible. In Germany as well.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. I mean, like, you know, for me, it's like, you know, I have little like models of K cars around here and stuff as well in my office. And what I really do believe is that the importance of that and the sharing of that as well. And I've, you know, have a little project going here in Germany at the moment to hopefully bring a few more K trucks to car shows and just to kind of show it to the wider public as well to hopefully get this done. And it's also just important for the people to see their other options, because I think sometimes here the regulations are not as strong, and I'm not saying they have to be, but then there's no incentive of bringing something like this over. And, you know, it's the point. It's like, if we don't have the regulations over here, it costs too much to homologate than a K car to bring into Europe on a volume scale. And that's quite sad, you know? So I really hope that you guys are in any kind of way in the future, bringing it away. But talking about innovation, so this is something that really baffles me. And I want to bring in that kind of idea of video games and stuff. Yeah. So if you look into the evolution of video games, and in particular UX, for me, the greatest UX ever created up until today is probably the Nintendo Wii, because it's a product where when you're 3 years old and you can hold the remote, and you're 99 years old or even 100 years old, you can still hold the remote, you can play the games. Yeah. And it's incredibly intuitive, but it's not the highest, you know, graphics quality. But in terms of the usage behind it, it's absolutely incredible. If I am, and I'm literally generalizing now for the very vast majority of Japanese companies, the UX in the car has been lacking, especially compared to, let's say, China, in particular, and let's say also the Americans and Europeans a little bit, but in particular to China. Now, with this innovation approach plus an existing massive understanding of what great UX is, what's the reason it never made it into the car on those various levels? Is it just that the car was seen as a car in that sense, and fundamentally that was the first thing that needed to be done? Because it's also like sometimes staggering to me in Japan is I see people with iPhones and then see people still with flip phones, in that context. So there's this kind of, you know, pro and con on all these different kinds of levels. So what is your feeling that this has not caught on to that degree yet to kind of see this innovation? Obviously, you guys have announced just very recently, I think, collaboration with Unity to develop something a little bit further. But why only now and not 5-10 years ago, when everybody else pretty much started with that and that trend of, call it, user experience has really pushed on? What's the reason for that?
You know, Martin, this is a real difficult one, but I think one thing is that we're still in the early days of that, if I look back, you know, and this is back to the end of the 80s or maybe in the 90s, I think the first navigation systems were in Japanese cars. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they broke it in essence, you know, they developed it, and touch screens were there. You know, it's a funny story, actually. You know, I remember, and this is 25, 30 years ago. Yeah. And we were working on an advanced project. And I said, why don't we put we took a display from a computer and we put it in the car and stood it up. And we put it in the middle of the car and said, why don't we do an interior like this with a touch screen and everything there? Yeah. And you could do it. It's kind of, you know, like what is 10 a penny now.
Yeah.
And you know what? At the time, you know, I was met with the reply from a lot of, and I won't mention any names, you know, but overseas. And this was during perhaps the BlackBerry boom. You know, when you have the keyboard and stuff.
Yeah.
And from an overseas market, they said, no, that's never going to work. Nobody's ever going to want to touch a screen. It leaves fingerprints all over it. And then lo and behold, a few years later, the iPhone comes out, and all of a sudden, well, you know, the rest is history. And I think, you know, looking back now, we were a little bit thrown at that time, maybe, you know, but I do believe, you know, already over the last 20 years, we've seen already a lot of, you know, swings and roundabouts in this industry, you know, even in the mobile market as well. You know, we've seen, you know, the likes of Nokia and those companies, and in the same in the internet world as well, you know, leading up to 20,000, you know, Netscape, and now it's Google. And I think still there's a lot of waves to come. And you know what, Martin, I think that the biggest point is not whether or not you put a monitor or whatever else in there, or create an operating system that is in some ways easy to use. The next big thing is, okay, we've moved past a point where we're bringing stuff from the outside world into a car, whether you've got karaoke there, or whether you've got your mail there, or whether you've got whatever. It's going to be about building an experience around the movement of the car. In other words, the content has to be derived from the fact that you are in motion. Yeah, we've said this out loud. And it's also going to be about how much your car is part of an integral system in terms of infrastructure. Those are probably the two big things. So in other words, it's not just, and I think nobody really has cracked that nut yet. So what I want to say is that things will change again, you know? Yeah. And I hope that we've seen this isn't a fad. It isn't a, you know, a passing trend or anything else. It's part of, you know, car design, it's part of transportation design. The fact that you're in a car, you're going to have to deal with even more information than you already have right now. You know, that is the future. And that's not all good. So one of the simple points about this, and we've talked about this at various points, you know, in the shows and stuff, is the ability for you to be able to drive a car or be a passenger of a car and sort through relevant information properly. So I think, you know, in a lot of respects, you know, finally we're getting towards a situation where AI has come into it, and that will enable you to sort through excess as well to a certain extent. But I think the next big thing is going to be those things, is literally how to build content from motion, and also how to make your car part of a bigger picture in your life, you know. You know, and hopefully that won't all be boring. of course, you know, the fundamental aspect is to nail safety completely. That has to be number one. And then once we go past that point, it's going to open up a whole series of avenues, I think, that allows that so-called world order to change again. You know, so
is that also, you know, projects like Woven City, like the Olympics, where you had the autonomous shuttle and those kind of things? Is that why Toyota overall is investing into those, let's call them experiments, that kind of next level? And does that give you that freedom to test things out without any boundaries, where also the engineers are saying, oh yeah, we can't do that? It's like, no, hold on. We have something completely new here, so we can rethink everything as well on the physical side, the geometrical side, but also the digital side.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in Woven City, you know, the way that we describe it is it's a test course. It literally is a test course. What used to be in the old days, you know, it's the 2-3 kilometer oval course in the middle of the technical center. Now it has to involve people. These solutions, these services, you know, a lot of people, a lot of companies trying various things. But the reality of the matter is that, you know, people don't want to overcomplexify their lives. They've already got enough going on as it is. They have their phones, all that side of it is all done and dusted. Is how to bring all of those things together into a meaningful synergy, you know. Otherwise it's just not going to work. You know, at the moment I think we're still in the position where a lot of people are willing to try things for trying things sake. In other words, it's new, I'll try it. But you know, I guarantee you 2 or 3 years down the road things will change again.
And how important are, let's say, in that kind of prediction and kind of making a good decision, and what you then say is like, okay, maybe we put some money towards that to develop that. How important are different markets for you, and then the studios in those markets as well? Because you have Calty, of course, you have the guys in Nice as well. And I happen to know the guys a little bit. And obviously they do products for their local markets, but also they do the products for international markets, where maybe they're not fully involved in, or like, you know, they're part of a competition in that context as well. How important are those studios for those ideations, you know, new directions, and also a little bit of a testing ground for you? Is that then also to kind of get a feeling of what happens in Europe, what happens in America? Or is this also just like, hey, what do you see from the outside, what we're doing here in Japan, and how would you interpret certain kind of things? Because I can imagine the Woven City example is perceived very differently in America, in Europe, and in Japan when you have designers in that specific spaces.
First of all the studios all around the world are absolutely critically important to us. That's been a kind of like a fundamental thing for this company, not just for Design Ucalty in Los Angeles, in Newport Beach. You know, that was founded, it's actually 50 years old now. And it's the single oldest car design studio owned by a mass manufacturer in California. So in a lot of respects, you know, I think that's what maybe a lot of people don't see from the outside. You know, there was that understanding that you had to go out there and see what was really happening. You had to breathe the same air, lead the same sort of lifestyle to understand what products those people in those regions might want. Incidentally, Martin, you know, we have a lot of studios around the world, but we don't do any competitions. I stopped that a long, long time ago. We work together collaboratively now. So wherever you are in the world, you're part of a big single entity in a way. And I think that's, you know, really motivating for people, you know, working for the company. But the other side of it is that each studio should have its own, how can I say, you know, its own niche, what they're good at. We work hard so that every one of those studios has its own, you know, place in the bigger machine. And we also try from time to time to throw projects out that are not in their speciality, if you like. For example, the guys in Europe working on a car for Southeast Asia that's only there. And that type of thing, I just think it's really important for designers. Designers, I don't know how to define it, but I define designers as problem solvers. You know, I don't like stylists. I think that's underestimating what we can do. You know, I think that they have to address these things as problem solvers. They have to go there, understand what other people want, and then use that as a source of inspiration, you know, in the way that they design the car, you know, or whatever it might be. So yeah, we try to keep things really fluid as well. And that's really, really important to keep people fresh. Otherwise, they just get, you know, they get stuck in a rut. And, you know, I'm a realist, you know. You know, design is not an easy job. You know, you've got to reinvent the wheel literally every month. And it's not easy to do, to sit back and say, yeah, what I did a year ago is now obsolete. You know, so I've got to do something completely different. And it takes a lot of discipline on the part of everybody, you know, who comes into this industry, I think. So, yeah, you know,
how do you influence that? How do you influence that yourself? Because you have these studios. Do you say, well, at some studio we have a capacity, so we send them a project because of capacity? Or do you also just listen in regularly and say like, well, you know, let's say the next K car, I want it to be done actually by the guys in America, because maybe they see it so differently because they have nothing in that kind of small size. And I see something there that I want to now test out. What's the feeling that you have, or like your own decision-making behind that to give a project like that seems so far away to a studio?
The first thing is, you know, I personally, from my own point of view as a manager, you know, I think that first of all, me as a manager, I never underestimate the potential of the people that I work with. In other words, really bluntly, I don't go around drawing pictures and handing out bits of paper for them to I tell the guys when I promote them, if that, you know, to a, for example, to a managerial role, don't draw any more pictures, because if you draw pictures, then everything stops at that point. You know, the guys under them will literally use that as a benchmark, and they know if they do something different, and then it's not going to go down well. They're managerial style, if you like, it has to be about, you know, raising questions, listening, throwing something out there that's maybe going to just say, hey, oh yeah, I haven't thought of that, but maybe I don't have the answer either, but just literally throwing the challenge at them. And you would be surprised how far these people can up the bar. And I believe in them. I think that's the main way to say it. But I think at the same time, you know, to be able to get to a point like that, you have to build trust. And I think a big part of trust is feeling like you can say what you want to say on both sides. So everyday conversation, just meaningless conversation as well, breaking the ice, if you like, between everybody. And that is a job in itself, is having that eye, is to be able to say, yeah, we're all in the same boat here. And you can say what I don't think that's right. You know, that's okay. You know, the main thing, you know, Martin, I think, you know, to create that sort of that environment where people feel safe in their own decisions and their own opinions. Because if you don't have that environment, then people just clam up and they don't say anything. And you know, design is a conversation. It's not a one-way order. You know yourself in the industry, you know, anybody says, I designed that car. I'm sorry, it doesn't really exist that. Yeah. Of course, yeah. They may be the instigator, the original creator of the direction, but to create and to realize that thing, it's a monumental effort of numerous people, you know, putting their efforts together. So, yeah, you know, the ability to work as a team and the ability to stimulate the team is critically important.
Yeah. So taking this as a last note, because I think we could continue on and on and on and on, but I know, you know, you're busy and I really, really thank you for having almost an hour with you on this one. But my last question, from what you've said just now, how would you define your role nowadays? Is it still a designer? Is it a managing designer? Is it a design manager? Like what after those kind of years now, you know, putting down the pen and directing people, what do you think is the two or three most important skills that you have to get to great results?
I would like to think that I was a motivator. I think that is the single biggest, you know, most important thing as in terms of a manager. In other words, that people don't dread coming to talk to me. Or, you know, in other words, they, you know, I would love to think that I can motivate people. And I'm not, that is not, does not mean talking down to them. It means working together with them so that they'll want to and enjoy doing what they're doing. I think that's what I would love to think that I am. From a company point of view, I think, you know, what the responsibility that it's not just me, Martin, but we as designers have is to try and somehow paint a picture of a possible future. Nobody knows the future. Nobody's going to hold you to it and say, oh, you know, no, it's not. You know, okay, well, how do you know it isn't? You know, so, but I think there's sometimes there's a lot of hesitation by designers. They should be, and we should be, and we try to be, just as in a lot of ways, quite simple, you know, just say, yeah, wouldn't it be cool if the future meant something like this? And then, you know, if you can do that, yeah, and we do that, we try to do that every month, and we bring in Akio you know, all the other guys at the top of the company, and we stand around real products, which is basically the picture of what the future should hold. And I found over the years that if you have that discussion with something that is tangible in front of you, yeah, then you get a positive discussion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, people say, yeah, that's cool. I don't know how we're going to put 24-inch wheels on it, but it certainly looks, you know, generally speaking, and it looks cool. So let's think about what we're going to do. And then the other side of the conversation is that you can say, well, yeah, love to do this, but, you know, honestly speaking, we're going to need to do some compromising somewhere along the line, but at least you know where the North Star is, you know, and then when you start to make compromises or cuts or whatever you might want to call them, at least you're doing it in the knowledge, you know, how much that will actually affect that direction that you set out as an idealistic goal. And, you know, it's a lot easier to do it that way. And I think that, you know, at least from my point of view anyway, I see not just me, but me and the guys that work with me all over the world, is that it's critically important to put yourself out there and say, this is how I think it should be. And incidentally, Martin, and I will say this because you know, that doesn't just mean styling either. That means product concept, packaging, grading, all the issues that affect what that product in branding as well within that. And then being able to say, yeah, that's a possible future. And then the conversation inevitably from there is positive. And even if it isn't, if that just gets said, no, that's wrong, at least you know where you don't want to go from the next step. Yeah. So that's positive as well. You know.
Yeah, of course. But that's the way you should see it. You know, I think for a lot of people, this kind of idea of the word no, is something bad. It's just like, well, no means, well, maybe not this one. So I have a chance for another one and I can, you know, refocus on certain things. It's also like, you know, not wasting your time. And I think it's so fundamental. And I 100% agree with what you just said. The idea of learning what design actually is and the craft behind it, that it's not just a sketch, you know, it's as simple as also understanding why is a budget in place, you know, or why are we defining a product in a certain kind of way is absolutely crucial. But it's something that maybe has lost a little bit of track over the past decade or so, because there was a lot of styling happening and, you know, we do a lot of rebadging and those kind of things. So it's just styling based on old products. But I do agree, but this platform needs to be created. Yeah. So you need the comfort and also the courage. And that courage is the trust, in my opinion, in the end, to show something that is maybe outside the box, you know, and not just being shut down because it's different.
Yeah. And, you know, Martin, you know, don't worry about time too much, but, you know, just the, if you look at what's happening now within the industry, you know, I think, you know, maybe 5-7 years ago, maybe a little bit more, there was a point where that was exactly what was happening, what you just described there. You know, people were, you know, what's the next big thing? And then we've seen powertrain come to the forefront, you know, electric cars, you know, fuel cell cars, hybrids, whatever else. We've seen autonomous come at this almost at the same time. We saw the, you know, what they, the so-called case things, you know, the, you know, connected stuff and all the rest of it. But in a lot of ways, the way I see it anyway, is that we literally had everything that could possibly influence design. It was like the perfect storm. Yeah. And it all came simultaneously. And it's still, we're in the maelstrom at the moment, I think, a lot of that. I think that a lot of people see, electric cars, they believe that that's an incredible opportunity for design as well. You know, forget the actual powertrain issues here. In terms of packaging, it is. Is it perfect at the moment? No. You know, so, you know, there's so much to be done there that's going to open up all new, you know, avenues for design in terms of the way that you can repackage a car and the way that you can redistribute space between man and machine. That's all going to come to a forefront. You know, theoretically, and this is going to sound ridiculous, but, you know, as a logical conclusion, if you get to a point where autonomous is finally becomes ubiquitous in society, the seatbelt will disappear. Cars aren't going to crash anymore. It's not possible, literally. And, you know, when you get to that point, all of a sudden, everything is up for grabs. You can make a car out of a cardboard box if you wanted to.
Yeah.
At the moment, a car is its singular function is to keep you alive, you know, in the event, the unfortunate event of an accident, as much as we possibly can. And, you know, that is its primary function. Of course, getting you from A to B is part of that as well. But I think that, you know, the next 10, 15, 20, whatever, how many years, literally right now, we're just opening up the door, you know? And is that a great time for designers? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because in the old days, when we started, you know, when I started, at least anyway, there was a two box, what we call, you know, the hatchback, and then the three box, the sedan, and a one box, which was the, you know, Carbova thing, and that was it.
Yeah.
You know, so
let me ask you, incredible. Let me ask you this. Now I'm really intrigued, and I'll take a little bit more of your time, because I think it's just a really interesting development on this. In Japan, as far as I know, there's no traditional transportation design education in the universities. It's all industrial design, product design. Now, if we're comparing this to Art Center, you know, what happens in Europe or in the US in general, where you have these traditional transportation courses that are all around mobility, but let's be honest, most is about actually just cars in that sense. Now, the way you're telling me how you guys are working, do you actually think that maybe less car design knowledge as a student coming into Toyota, in particularly in Japan, is maybe beneficial because you can mold people a little bit better in the mindset of it as well? Or is it a mix that you need to bring in and you kind of work with constantly? Or what are your thoughts on this? Because it's, to me, very fascinating to hear, but you also want to make sure that, you know, these people are not styling, and transportation design is moving more and more into styling again, whereas product industrial design is obviously has other challenges at the moment. So what are your thoughts on this when you see your own organization and maybe your own experience? Because you're not the normal RCA grad when it comes to that as well.
No, I think first of all, yeah, the most important thing is to have a diverse, you know, intake. You know, of course, the vast majority will come from, you know, the likes of Art Center, RCA, or, you know, all those type of, you know, basically car design institutions. In Japan, you know, they're based on product design, but they do focus on car design in university. So to some extent, it basically is a car design course. But the most important thing is that I think, you know, and maybe this is a kind of an answer to your question, but in some respects, it's better not to know everything, you know, and nobody knows everything anyway. But what I mean is that right now, you know, youngsters, younger people in design, in a very, very good way, because they don't know all the ins and outs of the industry or everything when they come in, they're incredibly fresh and open-minded. And that is so important in any job. Yeah. So in response to you, the most important thing is not to mold people, you know, in that respect, is to enable their learning, but also to be able to keep their individuality, I think is critically important. And, you know, if you're not careful, you can lose one or the other. I think that we try our best anyway to keep that individuality alive, especially when they've got so much energy and enthusiasm when they come into the company and they're ready to change the world. That's the best time, you know? And then the other side of it, Martin, is I think people with a lot of experience are incredibly important as well. And in Japan, it's the same in the UK or in any other country, you know, the master and the apprentice, that type of situation. There is a role for people with that vast experience to enable the youngsters to be able to achieve what they're trying to do, instead of letting them struggle and, you know, they've got this great sketch, but they can't quite get it into three dimensions. I think you've got to create a society, you know, a sort of a system or an organization where people are willing to help, you know, from a, mm-hmm. a position of experience, so that the youngsters can, and I say that, and it's not the right way to say it, but you know what I mean, for people to be able to realize what they want to achieve. And then again, the other side of it is that people with experience still have a lot to offer. I think that what they have to do is to kind of just put aside their know-how and say, yeah, I know that the engineer is going to flip his lid about this, but I'm going to say it anyway, you know? And, you know, that is important. And sometimes those ideas that they were scolded for, maybe they got in trouble for, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, can be done now. I encourage the guys here, don't try to think too much like an engineer. Engineers get paid to do that. So, you know, you have to challenge them as well. So, yeah,
I mean, as much as they will challenge you.
Exactly. It's not a one-way thing. It's a two-way spiral up type of process. It's got to be like that. Otherwise, you know, nothing's going to change. So, I've been in this company for 30 years, but I can tell you right now that the last 7 years, maybe 6, 7 years here, it's black and white compared to what it was 20, 30 years ago. You know, it's about, you know, holding, not, you know, that idealism up and saying, yeah, this is what we should be doing. Now, how the hell are we going to do it? In a lot of companies, and this is not just the automotive industry, it's everywhere, it's the other way around. So you've decided the package, you've decided how much it's going to cost, you've decided the coefficient of drag and then how much you're going to sell it for. And then you start thinking, so what type of car are we going to make? You know, that is not possible. That's not logical. But that is an unfortunate fact of life in a lot of,
you know. There's also, you know, the way I see this, I mean, like, you know, I'm a big fan of Hokusai and the kind of Japanese wood prints. Yeah.
Right.
And there's this, so also listeners, and I'm pretty sure you have been there, but in Tokyo, there is a Hokusai museum. It's a tiny little place, but they explain how the wood print works. And so, you know, and how many layers they're doing those kind of things. But in the end, what it does, he started off with a sketch and an idea of what he wanted to do. And then it became the complexity of the wood print. Yeah. So he knew that this was how it's done. But there was also this really nice side topic behind it. It's like, we all know Hokusai, but we don't know the guys who printed the Great Wave and, you know, the Fuji and all these kind of, you know, lovely pictures. And that's exactly the point. It's still a representation of absolute teamwork. And if that's two people or if that's 200 people, it doesn't make, you know, it just doesn't make a difference. And I always see this in Japanese culture. It's like you might have somebody who's standing in front of a crowd to represent something. Yeah, look at, you know, at Nintendo where, or like, you know, at Sony, there's always one person usually there. But at the same time, it's the entire team. And you can see that there's the teamwork involved, is that when things go down, it's usually the top level management that takes the pay cut so that they don't have to fire anybody. And that team building and this kind of, you know, team feeling behind it is, I think, where a lot of that comes from, because then there's no, you know, you're just, there's no jealousy in that sense. It's much more this kind of, oh, let's share something. Whereas I think a lot of in the Western world is a little bit more of what I would call the social media culture. It's like you stand there and you're the best and, you know, you've done everything and those kind of things, where then the teamwork automatically falls down. And that's really, like, you know, I think fundamentally also Japanese. I mean, just look into how sports are being played in Japan, like, you know, when they go out of the dressing room and everything is cleaned up, it's the sign of respect and the sign of we all do it together. And that's something that I think, you know, if you really look into the culture, is what makes the biggest difference, because it's not very individual. You can be individual, but you're still part of the team. But, you know, in the end, you win as a team.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, I think that, you know, Japan is making a transition, you know, over the years. It's definitely, you know, if you imagine the West on one side and Japan on the other, without a doubt, in some ways, they're both moving towards the middle, you know, in a way. I don't know. But, you know, I do think that Japan as a whole, it takes pride in the fact that you can be a team and achieve stuff, you know, and they enjoy that feeling of accomplishment as a team, which is an incredibly powerful thing. You know, over the years, they themselves have moved to embrace individualism as well. So there's a lot more individualism together, like you say, with that team, which is the right way to be, I think. And, you know, and in things like, you know, car design, the original sketch, the original idea, if you like, that spark of creativity, that has to be celebrated and recognized, you know, and we go out of our way to, whether it's a 22-year-old or whether it's a veteran or whether it's an, you know, whatever, you know, that part of it is made clear. That's never watered down or diluted. You know, the ability to create and to have ideas and to be responsible for that in the first instance is incredibly valuable, you know, and that has to be respected and valued. But after that, like you said before, that, you know, with the prints, the art itself has come there. So how are we going to make that, you know, and how are we going to realize that? And there's a lot of things that are not in that original sketch, and a lot of things that will disappear from that original sketch before it gets to a product. And they need to be the ideation needs to continue. So everybody, I think, you know, in some ways, Martin, it's about, you know, creating an atmosphere where everybody feels they've got ownership of that product. I think ownership is an incredibly important word. You know, if people feel ownership, they feel motivated, they feel, you know, ownership, they feel reward, you know, for the results, and they feel responsibility, you know. So you can say that, you know, if you have too much teamwork, too much, you know, that and the other, maybe you don't feel ownership anymore. You just feel you're one of a tribe of people that have been brought in to realize something. I don't feel that here. I feel, you know, that the guys, when they do things together, that they feel real ownership of that product. And that's incredibly important.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a fantastic kind of end to the conversation, because, you know, I guess I could continue on and on and on. But if I do that, you know, we will continue on and on and on at some point. You know, that it's going to take such a long time, we need to cut the podcast in 3-4 parts, and that never makes a lot of sense. But thank you very, very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. You know, I know you don't do these, a lot of, you know, a lot of podcasts or interviews and those kind of topics. So thank you really a lot. And I promise you that the design community overall will highly appreciate it. So really, it's been a pleasure to have you here, and I'll see you very, very soon. I'll be in Japan in a little bit, and of course, you know, we'll probably see each other somewhere around China for a show or something like that. So
all right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot, Martin. Really enjoyed it. It's great to talk to you. Yeah. Keep on pushing the big fight, if you like. You know, design is so easy.
I will do.
Really appreciate it.